And a very good morning to you. Welcome back into today's programme. A look at some of the texts and WhatsApps coming into us on 086 38 33 553. That's with thanks to rationale.ie. Keep Sinn Féin out of government. They would destroy the country. Only good for people on the dole. The working people would have to pay for their policies. Does your listener complaining about migrants realise that a large amount of us were invited here by the government because of our qualifications and Ireland's critical skills needs? Xenophobic much? Or just narrow-minded? What about all those children with back problems? What's been done for them? Michael D should look in the mirror at his own harvest and not tell us what to eat. The cheek of him. And well said, Kieran Cannon. That was far from a peaceful protest. Stopping people getting in and out of their workplace is simply wrong. And they keep coming in and coming in this morning. And if you're on phone reception as well, you can do so on 09177-0077. Email comments at goaibayfm.ie. Now, though, I have two guests sitting across from me in studio, Pat Flaherty, or Flannery, I should say, and Diane Jackson. They're both sector organisers with SIPTU, and you're both very welcome on to the programme this morning. Diane, I might start with you first. Good morning.
Good morning, John.
Talk to me about the SIPTU calls for a restart of the childcare pay talks, because I know that the latest rumblings with it is that the offer at the moment, that 5% increase, it's not acceptable in your view.
Absolutely not, John. SIPTU have been seeking to have a substantial increase in wages for early years educators, lead educators and managers. We represent the staff working in the sector. The offer on the table is just not good enough. The offer from the employers is $13.65 for educators. We believe that rate should increase by €2 an hour to €15 an hour. The government have invested in staff paying conditions in budget 2022. The government invested $207 million for improvements to paying conditions of employment, and we're seeking that that money is transferred to the staff's wages. There's a huge staff shortage out there. There's a staffing crisis at the moment. Over 60% of employers are saying they're having a major difficulty securing staff, and it boils down to the pay. The pay is the problem. These are professionals, they're qualified staff, they educate and care for the youngest people in our society. They need to be paid a professional wage, and $13.65 just won't cut it. And we're calling on employers to restart the talks, get into meaningful negotiations and start utilising the investment that the government have made and put it into the pockets of the workers. That's where it should be.
Now, I know that talks between government and the sector broke down last month. I suppose it could be argued that you need to be at the table to argue for this better pay condition.
Well, we have a crucial meeting coming up next Monday, John, and it's ahead of that meeting now. That's why we're out calling on employers to listen to what we're saying and listen to the educators across the sector. There's 26,000 people working in this sector. The society depends on these people to care and educate for their children, and people are just leaving the sector wholesale, going to other sectors of our economy where they're simply better paid, to other sectors of our economy that doesn't require the kind of qualifications these people have. Many of the people we're talking about are qualified, are graduates and level 7 qualifications, and their qualifications is transferable to other sectors of the economy where they can make a living and where they can get a more decent rate of pay.
Yeah.
So next Monday is a crucial meeting, and we're calling on the employers to turn up that meeting and engage in meaningful negotiations, and they need to go further. The $13.65 and the rates that's on the table won't cut it.
Yeah, let's break it down simply. So it was at €13. The government offered $13.65 per hour, and SIPTU and the early childcare sector wanted up to €15.
Well, the government put the money on the table, and they said, here's what we are prepared to invest in staff pay and conditions of employment. And employers and SIPTU, who's the union, which is the union that represents educators and managers in the sector, we have to go off and do the deal. So we have to get into a room, get around the table and do the negotiations. And where we're at is SIPTU want, for the entry grade of educator, we see that there's a capacity there to go to €15 an hour. The problem here is the employers won't move beyond their 1365, or they haven't done so up to now. And that's where we're at. That's the impasse we're at this point in time. And we're calling on them to move forward, because they will end up suffering themselves in the long run, because they simply cannot get the staff and they cannot hold on to the staff, which means that they end up closing rooms, which means a loss of revenue for themselves, because if they don't have the staff, they can't offer the service to the parents, which means that they lose the revenue from being able to deliver the service. So it absolutely makes sense to everybody, to providers, to employers, to staff, that the rates are improved substantially. It's also really, and there's research to back this up, it's really important for children's experiences and their outcomes that they have consistent educators working with them, that there isn't this high turnover of staff, that they need to be working with the same educators over a period of time to get the best outcome and have the best experience. So it's a win-win all round. We need employers to step up and do the right thing.
And when you say employers, you mean the creche owners, is it?
Absolutely.
So government have provided this investment, and you're saying that creche owners aren't transferring that into wages on the ground?
Absolutely, they're not. What they're saying is their offer is 1365. We're saying that's not good enough. We're saying it needs to be €15 an hour. That's our claim. But we're here to negotiate, and we have a crucial meeting next Monday in Dublin, and we're calling on the employers to come to that meeting with the view to negotiating and coming to an agreement to do the deal. But we're absolutely clear. Educators are telling us all over the country, 1365 won't cut it.
And for the employer side of things, I've had Elaine Donan and some local creche owners here as well, and they said there are a lot of restrictions on them, and there's a lot of things that they need to plug as well. And they say that government needs to do more for them before they can actually transfer that down to the employees.
Well, the thing here is that this €207 million that we're talking about was given for pay and conditions of employment. It's there allocated to employers to improve pay and conditions of employment. It's not meant to be spent on anything else or for any other reason except to improve pay and conditions of employment. Because employers too have said that pay needs to improve. But what they need to do now is utilise the investment that the government have made to improve pay, and they need to improve it beyond what's on the table at the moment. And we need to, over the years to come in the future, we will be going back to government looking for further investment in pay and conditions of employment. But right now there's €207 million gone into the sector since last September, and it can go further. There is capacity for employers to go further beyond the 1365, and that's what we're insisting on.
So that government funding can allow them to go to €15, in your opinion?
In our view, absolutely.
Okay, well, it's an interesting one. We'll keep on it. I just want to read out something here, because it's an issue that does need to be tackled, but there's another side to this, and that's the people who will be put out by this withdrawal of services. We got this email in from one of our listeners. My children attend a creche in Galway City, and they're among the largest creches and childcare providers in the county here in Galway. And the provider, which is part of a large group, has decided out of necessity to close next week for 3 days to protest against a lack of funding and support. And they go on to say that they have attached a letter to provide further information, and it says that the closure will result in a lack of income for me personally and a disruption in my day-to-day life. That comes in from one of our listeners. So it will have real impacts on the ground. So hopefully, as you say, this Monday meeting can sort this out before that withdrawal of service, that 3 day withdrawal of service.
I just want to make it absolutely clear that the closures that's been referred to by the listener in that email has absolutely nothing got to do with SIP2. It's very much
the early childcare sector.
It's the early childhood providers themselves that's organising that. The reason I'm here today, John, to talk to you is about the rates of pay and
the
money that's already been invested by government that employers have. And this is crucial. That money is for improvements in pay and conditions of employment, and it's our job to ensure that that money gets transferred to the workers, because that's the intention, that's the purpose of that funding. The closures, that's a matter for the employers, and message needs to be put to employers.
And I suppose another angle of this is that the employees in this sector, they're hemorrhaging out of the sector and going to other, and they're upskilling and they're going abroad into different sectors as well.
Absolutely, John. We see that every day of the week. We know recent information provided by the department tell us that 60% of employers are having huge difficulties with recruitment and retention of staff. We know there's a very high staff turnover rate, 25% of a staff turnover rate in the sector. And that's bad for quality. That's bad for children's outcomes and experience, because what children want is consistency in terms of their educators, the people that they deal with day in, day out, to get the best experience and the best outcome for them. So it's really crucially important for children and their experience that educators are incentivized to stay in the sector, and the sector is attractive and appealing for them, so that we can attract these people back into the sector. Because people opt and choose a career in early years, and then when they realise the pay and conditions, at a point in time they just find that it's not sustainable for them to live on it, and they cannot move on with their lives, and they cannot provide for themselves and their families, so they go elsewhere. And it's the sector and it's the children that lose these very valuable people.
Mm-hmm. Final one for you. I know that the IBEC group that represents providers, I know you're representing employees, but providers, Childhood Services Ireland, described the proposed increase as wholly unaffordable. And there are a number of grievances for the employers in terms of the freeze on fees and the core funding scheme and different things. Do you empathise with them as well?
Well, our focus, as I keep saying, John, is on the fact that there is investment by government for pay and conditions of employment. And our whole argument in this case has been that the money is there, there's capacity to go further with that money, and employers need to do the right thing by their staff and put a better offer on the table. Because, as I said many times, and this is educators saying this to us, like, if 1365 won't cut it, and educators will, if they think that this is what they're getting, they'll be gone from the sector, and the sector just can't afford to lose any more people. But there is this opportunity to do the right thing, and we're calling on IBEC and calling on the Federation to engage in meaningful negotiations and improve their position.
There also won't be a sector if the sector becomes unviable for employers. Which is what they're saying, the early childhood sector.
Yeah, we don't accept it, John. We don't accept that is the case. Simply because this is.
But there are centres closing down across the country. It's well reported on.
But what we also see as well is that the most recent data from Thusla is that the number of services closing down is the lowest that it has been in 5 years. There are always closures, but the most recent data that we've seen is that the number of closures now is at the lowest level it has been in 5 years. So it's very different story in terms of the official data and the official figures that's coming out from Thusla and from the Department of Children.
And do you think so, in your view, is this all a smokescreen from the early childhood sector?
Well, we deal in facts, and we deal with the information that we're being given by the Department of Children, by Thusla, and what I'm reporting here today is the official information that's there on record for anyone to see in terms of the number of closures.
It's an interesting one. I want to move on, though, because we also have Pat Flannery, another sector organiser with SIPTU. And Pat, you're talking to us about this campaign with the healthcare assistants, that you're looking for them to join the union.
Yes, John, good morning, and thank you for having me on the programme. What we're doing this morning in Galway Hospital is we're launching the Healthcare Assistant Day, and our intention is to roll that across all of the hospitals within the Celtic Group initially. And we're doing it on the basis, I suppose, when discussion is on in the media and media outlets, the healthcare assistants are often the forgotten group within the health service, and they are fundamental to the delivery of patient-facing care. And from our perspective, what we're trying to do is to ensure that the public understands that the healthcare assistants are fundamental to the delivery of care. They're part of the care team across the whole spectrum of care that's delivered. And from our perspective, we just want to ensure that they get the recognition and the respect that they deserve and that they have earned. And I suppose just to say, John, in relation to that, a recent job evaluation process for the healthcare assistants, you know, did result in recognition that the roles have evolved, that their role is enhanced and, you know, they were paid accordingly to reflect that.
Okay. And is there a lack of healthcare assistance in the union at the moment, or what is this day about?
Well, what this day about is, you know, quality, you know, quality healthcare is quality jobs, and we need to ensure that we continue to ensure that the healthcare's position is front and foremost, and that everybody understands that it is fundamental to the delivery of care, and it needs to be, you know, respected, recognised, and it needs to be paid appropriately, you know, for the work that they are doing.
Because I know particularly a lot of people in the healthcare setting, they are very, by nature and by personality, very caring, compassionate people. They mightn't always be ones that would put themselves forward in this regard. So is that something that you notice, that they mightn't be aware of, and the channels they can go through if they want to follow this line of thing up, and in terms of their pay increases and their entitlements, etc.?
Well, indeed, and I suppose if we look at the profile of the staff who, you know, who are currently working in the sector, you know, we have a lot of staff from all over at this point in time. Yeah. But it is important, you know, that they have a representative body, and that is us and SIPTU. You know, we have sole negotiating rights for the healthcare assistants across the country, and it is our intention to ensure that they are getting and availing of their entitlements that have been negotiated with themselves and the state down through the years.
Now, I know that HSE support grade job evaluation scheme, it did deem that the role needs to be rebranded, but also, crucially, a higher rate of pay as well.
Well, that was recognised in the job evaluation process. We are currently also negotiating the implementation of the Healthcare Assistant National Review, which was concluded in 2018. And there are 19 recommendations within that review, and we are currently in the process of having those implemented. Part of which, of course, would be the registration of the grade going forward. So that will put it on an equal footing then, of course, with all other healthcare professionals. You know, we do have to understand that it is a significant cog in the delivery of healthcare.
Now, you're down there in Galway University Hospital today. If healthcare assistants want to pop into you, what's the best way of doing that?
Well, we're there. We're very prominent. We're in the foyer, just at the lifts of the hospital. So we're very prominent. Delighted to speak with everybody. And so far this morning, we're there since 7 o'clock this morning. We have had a very good interaction with the healthcare assistants and indeed all the staff of the hospital.
And if people want to get more details, SIPTU, is that the best point of call? The website?
Yes, today we're there. Plenty of information. We have plenty of staff there and shop stewards and activists to be able to engage with everybody. And it is getting a very good reception from both the staff and members of the public who are passing through.
Brilliant. We wish you the best of luck with it. Pat Flannery and Diane Jackson, sector organisers with SIPTU, thank you both for joining us and coming in to Galway Talks today. We're back and we're looking at the Connacht Tribune headlines after these. And a very good morning to you. Welcome back into today's programme. Delighted to say I'm joined on the line by Dave O'Connell, the Connacht Tribune Group editor. Dave, good morning.
Morning, John. How are you? You'll have to excuse my cold, I'm afraid.
Oh, that's okay. That's okay. You're always.
I wasn't outside the door. I can't. You can't throw any of those suggestions at me. It's just a head cold.
You're always cold to me because I'm from Mayo.
I give you that one.
Your lead story.
It's in my nature. But anyway, sorry, I interrupt you.
You're all right. Your lead story, Dave, is a shocking court case.
It is, John, and for very understandable reasons, we've removed any details that would identify anyone involved. But this is a court case from Derry Ney District Court this week, where an order was granted to take a baby into state care a day after they were born. Tusla sought the order, and Judge Mary Fahey said she had no option but to grant it after hearing evidence from the baby's care team leader about welfare concerns. The court was told the baby has several siblings already in state care due to what the court was told was severe neglect by their parents. And just to underline that, the court heard that one of the newborn siblings had 20 teeth extracted due to care issues, and the children's, and this is a quote, basic care needs are not being met by the mother and father. A terribly sad, tragic case. The baby was born on Monday and by Tuesday was in care.
Now, the VFI has released details of a survey of publicans and how the cost of doing business is forcing them to the wall.
Yeah, I mean, John, this is the same cost that so many businesses are dealing with, energy costs, staffing costs, taxes, insurance. And we spoke to a couple of publicans in this area who genuinely fear for their future. And you know there's been a rate of attrition on this already. But Matthew Hughes, for example, he's the third generation to run his family pub in Ballinamore Bridge outside Ballinasloe. But he fears that without government help, he'll be the last. The pub is at the heart of the community. There's no shop, there's no community centre in Ballinamore Bridge, which most people will know, but it's outside Ballinasloe, near Newbridge. He says heating oil has doubled. There's been huge increases in electricity. You have to work hard on your clientele to keep them coming out. They want value for money, so you have to keep stuff happening. So he says he has music at weekends, a trad session on the first Friday of every month, a singing circle on the third Friday, card games like 25 on a Wednesday. And as he says, we set up a heritage society. We have women who meet up for a chat and a cuppa, not necessarily alcohol. We're looking to set up a group to get a defibrillator in the pub for security and to keep a charge. That's just some of the stuff, that it's not just customers coming in and having a drink. It's the focus of the community. But this is the reality for so many pubs up and down the county, but particularly in the country.
Mm. Now, when we had on ourselves this morning, there was a huge fundraiser for Galway Hospice in memory of David Cox last week, and we had Katie on. She spoke beautifully.
Well, look, they're a phenomenal family, the Coxes. I knew Dave myself, but I think everybody in Galway would know the Cox family, but also in my Cullen, because when David moved out there, as you know from that, one of his many talents was raising money for good causes. And for those that missed it a bit earlier, David died just over a year ago, way too young, after a battle with cancer, and the dignity and the bravery he had right to the end was just astonishing. So his friends in Mike Cullen GA organised the Friday game, a kind of a Sunday game on a Friday, if you will. Michael Lester back in the chair, Anthony Cunningham, Joe Canning, Michael Dyken, all on the panel. The incoming president of the GAA, Jarlett Burns, was there, as were 600 others, which is just phenomenal. And the most important thing is that it raised 140,000 for Galway Hospice. That is an incredible achievement and great testimony. I mean, the headline we put on it, he's doing it now from afar. So two pages on that and loads of photographs as well.
Now, it's the County Hurling Championship and Galway United is the focus in sport.
Yeah, now at the business end of the hurling championship, and indeed the football will be the same after this weekend, that's cover two, but the group stages in hurling are over, the quarterfinalists decided, and all the heavy hitters still standing, so John McIntyre looking at that. Loads as well on Galway United, who got raised the bar even higher on a terrific season when they dumped Dundalk out of the FAI Cup at the weekend. It just shows we won't be out of place with the big boys in the Premier Division next season, and they can secure that title with just a point away to struggling Kerry, which would mean that then that's the Kerry match is tomorrow evening, and that coming through, the fans would welcome the champions when they host Finn Harps, Ollie Horgan's old club, at Eamon DC Park on Monday night. So loads on that as well.
Absolutely. And what else have you, Dave?
Loads in there, John. Look at the latest census findings. Shows the number of young adults still living with their parents across the county has shot up by 14% in the last 8 years. I don't think they're doing it because they love us. I think they're doing it because they can't go anywhere else. So that is just one of a whole host of interesting facts and easily fills a page. What also fills two pages is court, and there's also a spread on the very talented Connemara siblings, Seamus and Caoimhe Iflaartha, from Ardmore, truly brilliant exponents of the Shannos tradition for which their area is renowned. The latest on the handover of Dungourie Castle to Galway County Council and back to Galway United, or indeed back to Galway Rovers, because a man who played for and managed the club 44 years ago is back in town next week. Former Glasgow Celtic legend Tommy Callaghan will be introduced to the crowd at the Athlone Town game tomorrow week. Wow. But he'll also take part in a questions and answers session in Cladda Hall with his old buddies Tommy Lally and Gerry Daly next Thursday night, which I have the honour of chairing. And hopefully it will be a night of nostalgia at a time of what is just great euphoria for the club these days. So I look back and I look forward all at the same time, John.
Well, yeah, you'll have your work cooked out for you there, Dave, with those lads on that panel. So best of luck with that.
You've met Gerry Daly. All you have to do is ask Gerry how you're doing, and that's an hour gone.
Dave O'Connell, the Connacht Tribune Group Editor, thank you for joining us on Galway Talks.
Thanks, John.
Now, though, I want to move to my guest in studio. I have Johan Verbruggen of Callan Tansey Solicitors in with me, because Callan Tansey Solicitors are to host forth a Pathways to Progress Medico-Legal Conference. Johan, good morning.
Morning, John. Thank you for having me on.
You're going to be busy up in Ballina and Mount Falcon tomorrow.
We are indeed. We have quite a day ahead of us, taking in speakers from a variety of circles, medical and legal.
Now, this conference, it's on neurological injury, and the law takes place tomorrow, as we mentioned there. Just talk to us about what's going to be happening and sort of who will be speaking and what's going to be discussed on the day.
Yes, so we'll be hearing from lawyers who are experienced both with the Irish and UK system of litigation, so cases to do with medical negligence. We'll also be hearing from experts in neonatology who deal with newborn infants and how they're cared for. And also neurologists, so people who are involved in treating and diagnosing nerve injuries and brain injuries. And as part of that, we'll be looking at, you know, nerve injuries and brain injuries that can occur at birth, such as cerebral palsy or Erb's palsy, right through to neurological emergencies such as stroke or brain hemorrhage. Looking at the medical aspects of it and about what's happening and what's in the future in terms of preventing those injuries and disorders, but also looking at the law, how the legal system addresses that, how people who have been injured due to improper care, how they're made right again through the system, and what improvements need to be made.
And is this event, is this aimed at people in the legal profession, or can anyone go to it?
Anyone can, but it's mostly aimed at the medical and legal profession, because mm-hmm. we will be having like that neonatologists, neurologists, but we'll have lawyers coming in from the UK. And we'll have lawyers from both sides, so those who work for the state and for hospitals in defending cases, and also lawyers such as myself who represent plaintiffs, so the injured patient, and in a kind of a collaborative sense to see what can be done to iron out difficulties, because the system itself is often, it takes quite some time for cases to resolve. We would obviously have a position that it could be resolved sooner by engaging with patients and their lawyers sooner.
Yeah. And now you yourself, Johan, I was talking to you off air, mm-hmm. I thought... Where's Johan from? Well, he doesn't have an accent from outside of the country, but yeah. It goes back to your grandfather.
Yeah, so I'm Uchtarard, born and bred, yeah. And my grandfather is from Antwerp, but dad is from Kilcoole and Wicklow, and he's a vet down here for over, well, since before I was born, so that's why I'm a Galway man.
Brilliant.
So, no Dutch.
And your journey into the legal profession, does it come from a personal experience and wanting to fight that case for other people?
It does, in the sense that... I have a nerve injury, so it's called brachial plexus palsy, or sometimes referred to as Erb's palsy. So that's an injury to the nerves that run from your neck down to your shoulder. It happens at birth. Ordinarily, the baby, such as like myself, I was a big baby. I was 3 weeks early and I was 11 pounds.
Wow.
Not necessarily unpredictable in that my mum was a type 1 diabetic. Diabetic mums can have large babies. And also my brother, who was 2 years older, when he was delivered, he got stuck at the shoulder. So that's... kind of that's where the problem starts.
Okay.
It's pulling on the baby's head while the shoulder is stuck can stretch the nerves between the neck and the shoulder. And in my case, all five nerves were damaged and a couple of them were ripped from the spinal cord. So that leaves me with a near total paralysis of my right arm. Mm. So like that, when mum and dad were looking for answers from the hospital, they didn't get them. And in some cases, a couple of doctors that she spoke to had told her that it was... One said it was her fault for not pushing hard enough. Another had told her that it was her fault for pushing too hard, essentially.
Yeah.
So they went to a solicitor because they wanted to get some clarity. And a lot of our job is really finding out what happened in the first place before we can have any idea as to whether or not there is that something has gone wrong that was preventable.
Yeah.
We have to find out what actually happened. And a lot of people that come into us haven't gotten that from their healthcare provider after something has gone wrong.
And how has that affected you growing up? Of course, you've had it since birth, so mm-hmm. you have nothing to compare with, but how has it affected you as you've grown up?
You're right. I'm not familiar with what it's like. I haven't lost something in that sense because I didn't have it in the first place. But I suppose growing up in a country where Gaelic football and hurling and rugby are big sports, you're obviously not able to partake in them or participate in those to the extent as your friends growing up. So that's frustrating if you're into sport like myself. And then obviously as a teenager, you know, you're more self-aware about anything anyway. So it can be difficult, but it did feed into my sense about what I wanted to do. And obviously in terms of careers, I would have had a number of avenues that were completely shut off because, you know, things like a trade or being a vet like dad, that was never going to happen because of the arm.
But you haven't let it hold you back because you're now a solicitor, one of the most prestigious careers that there are out there. So you've done well for yourself in spite of that.
Oh, thank you for that. No, yeah, well, it's a rewarding job in the sense that when you can get answers, even sometimes if you get answers for people and there isn't a case, people aren't necessarily, they don't come in looking for a case. They come in looking to find out whether or not something ought to have been done better. And if it had been done better, would they have avoided whatever has happened, whether it's the death of a loved one or their child might have cerebral palsy. So that in itself, it's a good thing to be involved in, and I can see that it means an awful lot to people when they do, when the case is resolved and they have some accountability, and in some instances an apology as well, which I would think there should be more of.
Yeah.
Because there's certainly examples that I've seen in my work where apologies really should have been given, but they weren't. And I always tell my clients it's not a reflection on them that they weren't apologised to. You know, they did their bit, they went this far, you know.
Yeah. I suppose the reluctance for apologies in that setting, is it to do with accountability and the afraid that they might be legally put at risk if they do that?
Well, they brought in the fact that you can make an apology without it being an admission of anything and without having any legal consequence. Yeah. I think it's more a cultural problem. I think it is, because I have clients who are midwives, I have clients who are nurses, I have clients who are doctors, and so I have a bit of an inside track, and it's a cultural thing about being able to admit among themselves, and sometimes they might feel that they're stifled by management. As we've seen what's happened in Temple Street recently in respect to the spinal surgeries, we're hearing now that there were concerns voiced internally, and that's shocking, but I'm afraid it's not very surprising for someone such as myself who sees something like that quite regularly. So in terms of apology and accountability, it has to start really between the doctor and the patient.
Because there is a narrative out there that people who go to the legal profession, they want to make their claim, and they want, but like a lot of people just want that bit of justice, and that bit of that apology, it means a lot more than anything else.
Yeah, really it does. I didn't get it. So speaking as someone who didn't get it, I can tell you it would have meant an awful lot. And, you know, medical cases are different from cases like, you know, where you slip and fall, where you can hear that people have been found to have been taking cases and exaggerating them. With medical cases, people come out of a hospital not knowing the first thing about what's happened because they're not doctors, and they simply want to find out whether or not there was something preventable about it. And in the event that there was and it was a preventable injury, you know, we engage with the hospital and their lawyers, but often it just becomes a protracted legal process. And in other jurisdictions, that's been changed to make it more, I suppose, litigant friendly, to make it easier on everyone, because it would reduce time and costs to everyone if there was earlier engagement and an earlier acceptance that that what happened was preventable and shouldn't have happened.
Now, the conference, as we mentioned there, the medico-legal conference is taking place in the Mount Falcon estate in Ballina tomorrow. Mm-hmm. If people from the legal and medical profession want to take part in that, is it booked out, or can they still do so? Or how
I
do they
was
do
told
so?
This morning, just this morning, that it has sold out. Now, I can give up my seat if someone wants to take my seat. You know, we might be able to.
But it's an important issue, and I think it needs to be discussed more, and you give a nice personal and legal outline of it as well, and we might look forward in the future to it as well, when there are different bits and pieces coming up that we can talk about on the record as well. But Johan Verbruggen of Callan Tansey Solicitors, thank you for joining us on Go Away Talks.
Thank you, John.
Coming up after this, we're looking at diabetes. And a very good morning to you. Welcome back into today's programme. I'm delighted to say I'm joined on the line by Dr. Kate Gajewska, who is the Research and Advocacy Manager with Diabetes Ireland. Dr. Kate Gajewska, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, everybody.
Good to have you with us, Dr. Gajewska. Diabetes Ireland's survey has provided some groundbreaking insights and experiences of people living with diabetes in Ireland, and it's also highlighted the need for development of a national diabetes strategy. Just go through some of the key findings for us, please.
Yes, thank you very much for having me in the beginning. So our survey was the first ever data collection of information of people living with type 1 diabetes, type 2 diabetes, and children living with diabetes. So what we have found is that people, for example, do not receive the care in a way as they are supposed to do it, according to the clinical recommendations and clinical guidelines. Up to 40% of people, adults with type 1 diabetes, and 42% of adults with type 2 diabetes haven't been seen twice in 1 year when it comes to diabetes appointments. We also know that people struggle to access multidisciplinary teams. There is a long waiting list to access technology, mainly insulin pump therapy for people people living with type 1 diabetes. And one last, of course, last but not least, people would like to discuss their mental health as part of their diabetes appointments, whereas psychological care is nearly not provided for people with diabetes, for adults with diabetes. In pediatric care, it looks a bit better. Appointments are there according to the clinical guidelines. Technology is there, so people are using technology, which is great. They also, some of them also have access to mental health specialists. So these would be the most important findings.
Yeah, I understand why there is more support there in peds in terms of younger children and getting it early, but it can have a detrimental effect later in life as well. We had someone on just beforehand who said his mother's diabetes affected her births as well, so it can really affect adults as well, and as you go into later life, all the way into when you go into retirement age.
Absolutely. It's a lifelong condition. It's a chronic condition since for the last 100 years, we have insulin, which means that we live with diabetes. It's not a fatal condition anymore. So we have to live with diabetes as long as possible and with as good quality as possible. So that's why receiving diabetes care, receiving good quality of care is absolutely essential to live your life fully and to live it safe. So to avoid diabetes complications, avoid DKAs, avoid severe complications, access to technology is also absolutely essential. So a child diagnosed with diabetes will live with diabetes for up to 80, 90, 100 years even, because we live longer and we have better care than 50 years ago, for example.
Now, I know another thing that was noted in this report is there was a note difference between Dublin and the rest of the country. How does Galway stack up, or how does the rest of the country stack up with Dublin?
Yeah, so there were a few differences. One was actually, there was one lack of difference, which was actually quite positive. So when it comes to uptake of technology by people with type 1 diabetes, so for example, the use of continuous glucose monitors or insulin pump therapy, there were no differences, which was quite surprising because we hear from people that that they have to wait very long when they are outside from Dublin when compared to Dublin. But one third of people, and that's definitely a difference, would have to access technology privately. So they access private clinics. So for example, that's the difference. The other difference is that people with type 1 diabetes, adults with type 1 diabetes, those outside of Dublin more frequently had diabetes-related complications, for example, retinopathy. For people with type 2 diabetes, those with type 2 more frequently when they are in Dublin are being seen by hospital teams, whereas those outside Dublin would be seen by GP practices and in the community care. So these are some of the differences, but of course the analysis is much longer. The full report consists of 70 pages, and these are just the highlights.
Now, I know the budget is coming around the corner, and yourselves in Diabetes Ireland, alongside the HC National Clinical Programme, you're looking for €5 million more to enable a more equitable access to continuous glucose monitoring. A drop in the ocean, really, in terms of the budget.
Yes, absolutely. So that's why we have two asks, which are not very costly this year. One ask is to provide better access to continuous glucose monitoring for people with type 1 diabetes. We know that the majority would be now using CGMs, but we also know that maybe 30-40% are still not having this absolutely groundbreaking technology that makes living with diabetes a lot easier and a lot safer. So that's why we ask for this 5 million. And of course, we ask the government to develop a task force to launch a national diabetes strategy, because what we really see is that diabetes care in Ireland is a bit uncoordinated, is piecemeal. We have very different groups working on very different aspects of diabetes, whereas diabetes is just one condition, and we really need someone to oversee everything, oversee the resourcing, oversee the hospitals, oversee the primary care, and of course pediatric care. So that's why we ask for the task force to develop a plan and to stick to this plan to achieve the goal of better quality of care for people with diabetes in Ireland.
Dr. Kate Gajewska, thank you for joining us on Galway Talks.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
And you can go on to Diabetes Ireland for more information on that. Now, I'm going to quickly go through a few of the coffee morning locations. I'll get the rest of them after the 11 o'clock news and death notices. So in Abbeynockmoy, it's today between 9:30 and 12:30 in O'Donoghue Supermarket, Abbeynockmoy. In Ardrahan on Saturday between 9 and 12, it's Phil Stankard and Ashing Brennan there in 19 Cashnan in Ardrahan. And today, it's also Anne-Marie Burke in Ballymacreave in Ardrahan. In the Athenry area, we have from 10 to 5 today in the fields of Athenry. And then today, tomorrow, and it's all day there in O'Flaherty's Pharmacy in Athenry. Also looking elsewhere in Athenry, the Caravan Hall, it's between 8:30 in the morning and 12 noon today. In the Ballinasloe area, there's a number of them, and I think we'll have to get to them after 11 o'clock because I could be here all morning reading these out, but we'll get them after 11 o'clock. And just a reminder what's coming up on the programme next, after the news and deaths, we'll have Declan O'Rourke. His A Whisper from Oblivion book will be discussed, as well as his upcoming tour, which is getting underway. And he'll be playing some live music for us. So all that plus lots, lots more coming up on Galway Talks between now and 12 o'clock. If you want to get a text and WhatsApp into us, you can on 086 38 33 55 3. And also email comments at galwaybayfm.ie. We're back after news.